The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 364, a student panel entitled On the Giant's Shoulders, Hugh Nibley's Influence on the Rising Generation of Mormons, with panelists Rick Jepson, Jill Fellow, Quinn Rollins, and Ryan Holloway.
I'd like to thank everyone for being here today. It looks like we're just about time to start, and we're desperately short of panelists. We had someone called me just moments ago to tell me she wouldn't be here, which I found, you know, helpful. And then someone else has suddenly stopped returning my phone calls today and last night, and I'm assuming he may not be here. So I hope everyone came in the mood to participate, because I think what may happen today is we may ask for a little bit of audience participation. It's a fascinating thing we have to talk about today, and I hope that that everyone, as I said, feels open. Please feel free to contribute as we go, because I'm sure nobody paid $6 to listen to my good friend Quinn and I talk. So, without further ado, this year we had the sad passing of one of the absolute giants in Mormon culture, Hugh Nibley. Just an absolute icon of a man, the kind of person whose name I think will always be remembered in the intellectual world that we have, and that has had no doubt a profound influence on certainly, I'm sure, everyone in the room, and probably on almost anyone in the church. I think, and have thought for a while, that his influence on a younger generation of Mormons is perhaps different than on our parents and on our grandparents who knew him as a contemporary. My grandfather's here in the room with us today, who was a professor at BYU and a contemporary with Hugh Nibley, who would have seen his works as they were published or would have heard him speak. Many of our parents had the same experience. Whereas for us, especially for me growing up, I think of Hugh Nibley as a force, as almost not even a person at all, but a collected works sitting on the shelf, something that we refer to authoritatively, something that said, well, Nibley says this. Or, you know, I had a seminary teacher once who the answer to every question was, well, Nibley says this or Nibley says that, and that was that's how you know it's true. He's a complex human being, certainly a human being, and I wonder how much that separation of one generation makes us more critical or too critical or not critical enough or et cetera. And that's the sort of thing I was hoping to explore today with a large panel. And I certainly appreciate all of your interest in it. And some of you aren't even related to the people on the panel, which is even kinder. You always have to call all the family up. So I certainly appreciate you being here. Because I had anticipated somewhat of a shortage, I have asked my father-in-law, Bob Gallimore, to moderate the discussion today and to ask the questions that we had prepared and agreed upon as a panel. He also has what I think is a fairly unique personal experience with being near Hugh Nibley, and I'd like him just to share that briefly to give some perspective of sort of what we're contrasting today, and probably several of you may have similar experiences that if you'd like to share throughout the discussion, would certainly be more than welcome. Without further ado, we'll begin that. Yeah.
I have the great fortune of being a fly on the wall, if you will, in a class that Dr. Nibley taught. A friend of mine was taking comparative world religions at BYU, in which there were 10 to 12 students who each specialized in a world religion. And much to my great surprise, as I expressed my delight in my friend being in that class, she said, well, you could come to class with me if you wanted to. I said, really? She said, yeah, there are two conditions. You have to sit and say nothing. I said, really? She said, yeah, you're just going to be a post. I said, that's okay with Dr. Nibley? She said, yes. So I went into class one day with her, and several things struck me. One was, as soon as his foot crossed the threshold of the room, he began lecturing. There was no, hi class, how are you? There was no greeting. It just was this rapid fire, off we go to the races. And Dr. Nibley was off and on his way. The other thing that struck me, looking back at sort of the topic we're talking of being a 20-something-year-old in my young 20s, and being with others in the class who are of that same age, was the great respect and deference that Dr. Nibley had towards those that were his students. Never once did I see him be condescending, patronizing, or in any way put his students, who were younger than probably all of his children, down in any regard. It was really a very, very interesting experience. To illustrate that, let me just share one facet of that class with you. They were studying the images of water flowing from a rock and evergreen boughs in each of these a dozen world religions. And as he would come to a specific parallel he was trying to draw or inference he was trying to make, and asking each student to relate how this came out in their respective religion, because each person was specialized in a specific culture, the Minoans, the ancient Greeks, the ancient Hebrews. My friend's specialty was the Hopi religion. And if they missed the point or connection slightly, he was, in a very gracious way, said, "Well, I'm sure if we had time for you to reflect, or if I'm certain it's just an oversight on your part, as they had omitted some part of that parallel or connection." It was really fascinating to me to see someone who at this time was considered a giant within intellectual circles at BYU, to see the great deference he had towards his students. So that's a little of my background with Dr. Nibley. Our first question helps our panelists establish some of their familiarity with Dr. Nibley's work. So to each of the panelists, our first question is, what has been your personal experience or exposure to Dr. Nibley? Have you ever heard him speak in person? What of his work? How much of his work have you read? How much have you heard him quoted or referred to? And we'll just start and move right down the line.
Thanks. I sort of touched on this before, where growing up, Hugh Nibley was constantly, I think my used as almost like a legitimizing force. My dad would frequently refer to Hugh Nibley as being sort of a person who really put BYU on the map, where BYU could say, well, do you have someone who speaks this many languages, who knows this much, who can just at will, has this encyclopedia where it can pull out, and quote lengthy passages. And so I frequently remember him being mentioned as the person that was sort of, this person that you could always refer to and always have this intellectual backup of your testimony, that you could always say. In fact, I had a very good friend once say to me, said, "I'm surprised that Hugh Nibley knows as much as he does and is still a Mormon." Meaning, it seems like if I knew that much, I would have found a way that the church obviously couldn't hold together. And so since Hugh Nibley does know that much and is still a Mormon and so supportive and so loyal, then I'm okay with what I know and I can just rely on that. And I think that's a bad, at least long term, I think it's a bad crutch. I did have an opportunity once to hear Hugh Nibley speak live just after my mission. He spoke at BYU. And with my fiance, we talked about it and realized that it may be a unique opportunity to go and hear him speak live. And this is a man who I had really discovered his works during my mission when I wasn't supposed to be reading him at all. I read several of his books throughout my mission and fell in love with him and really was hugely influenced by what he had to say and the insights he had and some of the views that I felt he had that I thought were unique to what I'd heard. We did go and hear him speak. However, since we were only a few hours early instead of 12 or 18 hours earlier, I have no idea when people got there, we were shoved back into a room that didn't even have video feed. It just had an audio feed. And so we stared at a blank wall and heard him speak. So not exactly a personal experience. I'm sure he didn't remember my name from the experience. I have heard him referred to and quoted throughout my life with varying amounts of authoritativeness, with varying amounts. And I think this has had a tremendous influence on me and on my testimony, and particularly on my intellectual beliefs about the church or about the significance of the gospel and the temple and some of those things that we'll discuss more. Quinn, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay. My name is Quinn Rollins, and on your program I think I'm referred to as a bona fide eccentric or idiot or something of that nature, and that part is correct. I I teach junior high, and I've known Rick for quite a while, and I've known myself for longer, and I don't know what else to say about myself. So about my my own personal experiences or exposure to Hugh Nibley. I guess I am a good person for the panel because my experience was very different from Rick's experience, and I'm assuming from our two absent panelists. I didn't ever really go to seminary. I went for about a year and a half before I was told I was going to hell for laughing too much in class. And now that I'm a teacher, I can see where they were coming from, and I probably am. But in any case, I didn't really have that experience of getting to hear Hugh Nibley referred to as the authority to end, you know, discussions. And it wasn't until my mission that I was really exposed to him. And like Rick, I started reading contraband Hugh Nibley books on my mission, and really came to enjoy that experience. It's been mostly the anthologies that I've read, and I've read most of those, and have enjoyed those, and we'll get more into those in a little bit. And other than that, I know that I feel like he's really shaped the feeling of discussions about gospel topics. And we'll get more into that later. But I think the title of the discussion on the shoulder of a giant is apt because I've never seen Hugh Nibley. I never met him. I never I've seen some of his lectures on BYU TV, and those are still playing on BYU TV. So if you have cable, you should check that out. But I have felt his influence, and I think that his influence is going to continue to be significant for our generation and beyond.
Now to our next question. Have any or which of Dr. Nibley's works had a particularly significant impact on you, and how have they influenced you?
Thanks. In getting ready for my mission and going through the temple for my first time years and years ago, I had one of the most profoundly negative experiences I could have imagined. I was absolutely unprepared for it personally, on a spiritual level and probably on any level. And I was so relieved years later, not a year later, about to read Dr. Nibley's amazing writings about the temple, and to read that when he came out of the temple his first time, he found himself sort of dazed and confused, sort of just bewildered by the experience, without having absorbed much, without having understood much, and with being mostly confused. Of all his works, the ones that have meant the most to me have been about the temple, about the great love he had for the temple, and about the great insight he had about it. It's become where now I love going to the temple so much more than I love going to church, which I really struggle to do, because I don't. One, because my kids aren't in the temple with me, and so I'm not in the hallway for 3 hours chasing them. But I've grown to enjoy the temple so much, and it's become such a center of my testimony and even of my being. And I attribute a lot of that to the insights that Hugh Nibley had and that he was able to share through his writing. On top of that, the tremendous courage he had to talk about all kinds of things. I read a great tribute to him by Robert Reese, who said that in the mid-70s, when Dialogue was attempting to publish a series about our former policy of racial exclusion in the priesthood, that he, while they were running these amazing art, these really, really amazing pieces that were incredibly insightful and that, in my opinion, really shaped the direction that we've gone, Robert Reese said he was constantly looking for scholars to respond to these pieces and to give some insight and some feedback. And time after time after time, people would refuse to do so because they didn't feel that. Basically, they felt that they were worried they would be put, their membership might be put in jeopardy, or et cetera. And he said, of all those people, Hugh Nibley could be counted on always to discuss things openly, to talk about things that were hard to talk about things that were unpopular. Hunebelle once said that our weaknesses are like dogs. If you run from them, they chase you, and if you attack back, they run from you. And that's meant a lot to me, and has had a profound effect on me as I've tried to face my own fears and try to be as brave as I think he was in discussing things that easily could have made him less popular or put him in some kind of the same thing that held other people back, essentially.
For me, again, my biggest exposure was through the anthology series that's still available now, and of those, I would say like Rick, the volume about the temple, I think it's called Temple and Cosmos, has really shaped my relationship with the temple. And like Rick, I mean, we both have, I think, a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. The temple can be a place of peace. But beyond that, I feel like I learn more going to the temple than I would if I hadn't read Dr. Nibley's book, and I'm grateful for that. And the others are the ones, and I know these are popular as well, are the ones dealing with the Book of Mormon and the Old Testament, particularly Lehi in the desert and Abraham in Egypt. Both of those, that their impact on me personally is that they took the stories of the scriptures and moved them from the realm of myth and bedtime stories and fairy tales to something more tangible, made me realize that these people, Lehi and Nephi and Abraham and all these other prophets, were real people. And whether or not the connections he made between prophets and our real world of science and archaeology, you know, some of those have panned out and some of those haven't. But for me personally, it made me realize that I can look to sources beyond what's in my gospel doctrine manual or what's in my topical guide in my scriptures to find out more about my testimony. And that's probably the largest influence the Dr. Nibley's work has had on me.
I wanted just to build on something Quinn said. I think that really something that stood out to me has stood out to me about Hunebelle is that he took things like the Book of Mormon or like the temple experience and didn't treat them like the kind of thing where you sit back and let it happen to you, but the sort of place where you take it very, very seriously and you really study it out the same way you would study out anything in a science, anything in a hard science world, where in the temple you hang on every word and you think about every aspect of the presentation and really try and derive an intense meaning from that, so that it turns into a couple hours of really thinking and studying and working instead of just sort of sitting back and coasting for the ride. I think he was unique in some ways, and that's what's had a big influence on us as we've read those works.
Next question. Do you feel less enamored of Dr. Nibley's persona than your parents' generation may have been? Do you hold him to a higher level of scrutiny? If so, is where you're at good or bad?
I think this is where we're having a little bit of a departure from what we've done so far. We've been here about 20 minutes, and I think so far we've just had a tribute to Hunebelle, and probably wasn't totally our intention, and maybe not what was expected from some of you. And we're not here. It's very, very intimidating. This is why I think we have two people instead of the six that originally said they'd be on this panel. It's very intimidating for a 20-something-year-old who's desperately behind in school and has no initials, no letters at the end of my name, to sit here and profess to have any criticism of something as someone as magnificent as Hunebelle, as accomplished and as influential in the church. But I do, in reading his works, we do find these some things that appear to me to be exaggerations or to be maybe connections that are not as strong as they are presented. And I asked my dad about that. I said, you know, did this ever stand out to you when you were actually going to his class or listening to him speak, or when the stuff that was published was fresh, that it was just coming out, it wasn't bound, you know, in the 13 volumes on the shelf? And he said, he kind of just said, well, you guys are just more mean than we were. You know, he said, one, yes, we just loved him, and he does have this amazing wit and this, you know, this personality that's very magnetic, and that was certainly a part of it. And he said, and also, I just don't think that we tore things apart quite as much as you guys do, that we weren't quite as hypercritical. And I've reflected on that being, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is it good that that I can sit here and read the same piece and just line by line just want to check through and double check and want, you know, to be that critical? Am I missing a bigger point? I had something that was right at the edge of my mind that I was trying to switch gears because it was more important, and I've totally lost it. I do think, though, that this generation apart, where we didn't know him as a person, does make a really profound difference in the way that we view him. That we don't—he's not sort of this fatherly figure that we've grown to love as a person, because we've grown to love his works more than him as a person. And I think that does have a big effect on the way in which we read him and the way that his information is absorbed and the way that we apply it.
I'm trying to remember something important that Rick was going to say, but I can't remember it either.
He forgot it.
I sort of feel like Dr. Nibley's finishing point in where he arrived at with his works is our starting point. And so it's okay to criticize, to tear things apart in Rick's words, because he's brutal. To take something from that finishing point and to start from there, I think is only natural. I do feel like there's been a sort of fundamental change in the church, and that it's okay to discuss these ideas and to bring them out. I don't think there would be a sunstone or a dialogue or this same nature of discussion about things if it hadn't been for Dr. Nibley. And I think he would expect that his ideas would be discussed and debated, and you know, whether he would agree with those conclusions or not, I'm sure he probably wouldn't, because he's the one that came up with them. But I do think that there's been a fundamental change in the way these things are discussed, and that's to be expected.
I would say on one occasion I know that someone was highly critical of one of Hugh Nibley's works about the facsimiles. Another LDS scholar wrote sort of a pretty harsh critique about it, saying, you know, this is where I think all the facts were wrong, and gave it, sort of listed them out. And Hugh Nibley wrote a response to that. And his first line was, "Three cheers to Brother So-and-so for stepping up to the plate and for doing this." And he said, I absolutely, as a policy, don't hold myself responsible to anything that I said more than 3 years in the past. He said, all my conclusions are constantly changing. All my information is constantly improving, and I'm going to make mistakes along the way. And I don't think the only thing that I think makes us feel comfortable about saying, you know, how is this group of 20-somethings going to sit down and possibly dare to look at Hugh Nibley with some objectivity and to say, well, I like this, but I don't like that, is that I think Hugh Nibley would be the first person to encourage that. I think he was that type of person, and I think maybe that's one of the things that all of us like so much about him, is not just that he was this towering giant intellectually, but that he was so open to criticism against himself. I'm sorry if I said something that's making you leave. I'm just kidding.
I'm just grateful that we earlier had a demonstration of a senior moment in somebody more than 3 decades my junior. I'm really grateful for that. Next, I'm going to read 2 excerpts. First is a criticism, the second is a defense of Dr. Nibley's work, and then we're going to get reactions to that, and I'll summarize how we want the 2 panelists to respond after I read these 2. The first is from Professor Kent Jackson of the Ancient Scripture Department at BYU. Nibley shows a tendency to gather sources from a variety of cultures all over the ancient world, lump them together, and then pick and choose the bits and pieces he wants. By selectively including what suits his presuppositions and ignoring what does not, he's able to manufacture an ancient system of religion that is remarkably similar in many ways to our own, precisely what he sets out to demonstrate in the first place. There are serious problems involved with this kind of methodology. This is from Robert Reese and is in defense of Dr. Nibley. If he, Dr. Nibley, had a tendency to see too many parallels, he knew so much about so many things that it was difficult for him not to draw our attention to those things, many things that he considered relevant. And it is safe to say it's doubtful that any of his contemporaries, certainly not any of his Mormon contemporaries, knew enough to challenge Nibley on most subjects. So, to the panelists, how significant are these criticisms and defenses of Dr. Nibley's work to your opinion of Dr. Nibley? Do you feel they're justified? Do they color your perceptions? Do they have more or less impact than they might have had on your parents or grandparents' generation?
This is really, I think, the maybe the most important aspect of the discussion is when we run into these problems, this sort of lumping together or these pulling certain things out of context and creating connections that not everybody sees, how big of an impact does it have on us? And I would say, me personally, it devastated me when I first discovered that this was the case. I mentioned earlier, I think it's unhealthy to lean on anybody too heavily for your own intellectual or spiritual testimony. And I had leaned so heavily on Hugh Nibley that when I discovered on my own a bad example of this, I was really devastated. I felt like, in some sense, if you read someone enough, if you read enough of one person's writing, for example, like C.S. Lewis, I've read a lot of C.S. Lewis's books, you get to the point where you almost feel like you know them as a person, where if you met them on the street or you met them after this life, that you would have a lot to talk about and that you'd want to tell them right away how appreciative you were and how you almost thought of them as a friend. I had gotten to this point where I was so enamored of Brother Nibley and had read so much and he had so much influence on me that I truly thought of him as someone almost like someone I knew. One of my favorite things he ever said was a quote of Brigham Young that was given in one of his most famous speeches, and that was at a BYU commencement and has now been published as the speech, Leaders to Managers, The Fatal Shift. I think many of us have probably read that one. It's a fantastic piece, a fantastic speech, where he says the famous were gathered here in the black robes of a false priesthood and talks a lot about the difference between managing and leading. He quotes Brigham Young as having said, quote, "There is too much of a sameness in this community. I am not a stereotyped Latter-day Saint, and I do not believe in the doctrine. Away with stereotyped Mormons." That stood out to me so strongly that Brigham Young would have said that I typed it out and put it in quotes, and I hung it up on my wall in every missionary apartment I was in for a year and a half. That was the first thing that went up. Before I unpacked any bags, I put that on the wall to let my companion know that I was going to be a thorn in his side for as long as we were together, and that he'd always look back and regret having been my companion. I came back after my mission and wanted to have a specific reference that I could refer to that same quote. I tried to look it up on my own and was not able to, and after a lot of searching, found that the dot, 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 dot between the two halves of that quote were a huge leap, were a very big, and that's where I think sometimes Nibley does fall apart, is on the dot, 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 dot between the quotes, where some passages are so full of dots that you really don't know what's in between. As it turns out, the first half of the quote was said 9 years, 9 years after the second part of the quote, and that the context of each half actually contradicted the conclusion of the two put together. That really, not only were the speeches given almost a decade apart and in two different places, but that the material in the actual speeches somewhat contradicted the conclusion that was being presented. I can honestly say that it hurt my feelings and that I was actually upset with Hugh Nibley, with the person Hugh Nibley, that I was a little angry and had a period there where I refused to read any of his work and where I didn't want to talk about him because I had leaned so heavily on him that to have this house of cards just fall apart was really devastating. I think, though, in retrospect, a few things. One, this just happened last year, too, with Stephen Ambrose. He's this fantastic... Quinn, being a history teacher, may actually not think he's that great, because a lot of historians don't seem to like Stephen Ambrose that much. But he's this fantastic historian who writes sort of this popular stuff instead of the real meaty academic history. I just love him to death. And the year he died, it turned out somebody was reading through one of his books and realized that Ambrose had plagiarized him, the guy reading it. Had written a short book about his own... Well, I'm giving way too many details. Stay afterward. I'll tell you. It's a great story. Anyway, he realized that he had been plagiarized by Stephen Ambrose, investigated it further, and as it turns out, that almost every book by Stephen Ambrose had these gross plagiarisms. Now, he's still one of my favorite human beings. I still think his books are fantastic. I still think his view of historical events is absolutely phenomenal and very, very insightful. And I still love his books and I still read his books. And essentially, that helped me kind of come to the same conclusion about Hugh Nibley. The dot, dot, dots are a little tiring, and now I'm skeptical when I see a quote with a dot, dot, dot. But I love Hugh Nibley, and I love his conclusions, and I love his insight. And I have to remind myself that when he gave this quote, he didn't type it out. He was giving a speech. I think there's a tendency when you're speaking live to be able to make these little mistakes a little more careful. You know, a little... Gordon B. Hinckley misquoted a scripture when he was on Larry King Live a few years ago. He misquoted Galatians. Well, nobody wrote in letters and said, well, the Galatians doesn't say that. It actually says dot, dot, dot. Because the essential message was still there. And because when you're speaking live, things like that happen. I think it's one of the reasons why these little mistakes aren't that glaring to my father or perhaps to my grandparents, because they heard it live, or at least were there when it was said. Whereas I'm reading it in a book, and it's like I have this expectation that anything that's published would be just 100% accurate. And so when it's not, then that's, you know, if you don't know the person, you only know the work. I think it's a little more glaring. I don't even remember what the question was. But sure, here we were worried we wouldn't be able to fill up the time. I would say that the criticisms are somewhat valid, but I would also say that the rebuttal to that criticism, that if he saw connections, maybe it's because he knew so much more than the average person, that maybe he saw connections that really are there, but that some of us don't see with just a little piece we know, like this famous allegory of the 10 blind men feeling around an elephant, and each one of them has a completely different idea of what an elephant is. Maybe he knew enough more that as flimsy as maybe some of his connections appear to us, maybe some of them are better connections than we think. And maybe he knew Brigham Young well enough to know that Brigham Young could full well have said a statement like this, and it didn't seem out of context for him to have accidentally misquoted it. Amen.
Well, I think when it comes to criticism and defense of Dr. Nibley's writing, I'm not a very good one to judge. I was raised in a household, and my parents are here too, so yeah, I warned them not to come. But I was raised in a household that where we were raised to be skeptical and critical and to think for ourselves and. Man, that's a big burden to put on your kids. So we were raised to think about things and to read books and horrible things like that. And so I think when I read something, I'm automatically skeptical, critical. And I try to pick out things that will help me, and at the same time I'm looking for things that I don't need to hold on to. And I do that with Dr. Nibley's books as well as with many other things. And so I didn't, you know, when I read criticisms about anything, it doesn't really hurt my feelings. And you know, I don't have any feelings, so it's okay. But I think when you look at his body of work, I think he really opens ideas about history and philosophy and makes connections with the gospel. And that's where a lot of us fall in love with Hugh Nibley, is the connections he makes. And if some of those connections are more tenuous than others, if there are some leaps in logic, that's fine. But ultimately, it's the connections he makes with the gospel and with our own testimonies that make him a more permanent figure in LDS history and LDS thought. I I think there are a lot of places in Dr. Nibley's books where he says things are connected, and I read it as these may be connected, or this may have an influence on that. And for me, I think he's given us a framework to look for the gospel in all parts of my life, not just the scriptures, not just what happens on Sundays, but in all parts of our life. And if that's in a history book, if that's in a TV show, if it's in the news, then that's where you can find things to help support your testimony. And he's just done that in a more compressed form in his works than a lot of others have done. And for me, I think a good deal of my testimony now comes from things that are outside the standard works. And I'm able to do that maybe with a more critical eye, but also with a more seeking eye, because I've read Hugh Nibley's works than I think I'd be able to otherwise.
Something Quinn said too earlier about Hugh Nibley being, first of all, this image of standing on a giant's shoulders, which is almost a cliche now. It's been used so much, but it's a valid sort of a thing. You're really standing on this giant's shoulders. Quinn mentioned sort of before Hugh Nibley being a launching point for us, kind of a where can we go from his works. And you already see sort of some of his best works being rewritten with just with a few less dot, dot, dots. Somebody wrote a fantastic piece about baptism for the dead in ancient times. And when I first saw it, I thought, well, why even bother doing that when Hugh Nibley already wrote a fantastic piece about baptism for the dead in ancient time? And it basically, I think we're seeing that a lot in LDS work. We're seeing people who will write something and actually pay tribute to Hugh Nibley, actually say, Hugh Nibley really started this, really laid the groundwork for this, and now that we know a little more, or now that we want to focus a little more, here's what... It's almost like we're rewriting it, which is a little more, with a little higher level maybe of that academic scrutiny, but still paying the tribute to him and saying, if it weren't for Hugh Nibley, we wouldn't probably be writing this piece in the first place or going this direction with our research in the first place.
Next question. Dr. Nibley was out on the more liberal end of the political spectrum, a conservationist, a pacifist, in a culture where these attributes can sometimes be hard to come by. How significant are his socio-political positions, and how much are those, contrast those with your parents and grandparents? What impact do you think those positions have had on the older generation versus you as 20-somethings?
I sometimes tend to think this is really what we love about Hugh Nibley, is that he's this totally beloved figure, but at the same time, he's really very much a nonconformist in what can sometimes be a very conformist culture. And to see someone at that, somebody famously said that no good Mormon could be a Democrat not that long ago. I've heard that used actually in arguments in like gospel doctrine class, where people say, "Well, somebody said, who later became a prophet, said no good Mormon could possibly be a Democrat." And here's Hugh Nibley, not only a Democrat, but writing and saying things that could easily be interpreted as pacifist, conservationist, etc., and his level of loyalty, his towering intelligence, and then his level of loyalty and the strength of his testimony were so strong that he could say things that I think if I said in church, I would be never invited back to Elder's Quorum. My very favorite thing he ever said, this quote of his, it just really stands out to me. He says, "There may be things about the church that I find perfectly appalling, but I know the gospel is true." He saw this difference between the gospel and the church that worshipped it. And he was able to say, there are things in the church I really don't like, but I know the gospel is true, and that's what's important to me. I don't know if anyone else could have said that the way he said it and have it received the way that it would be received with him saying it. And like I said, I don't think I could raise my hand and say, well, there may be some things in this word that I find perfectly appalling, or some things I find... did you...
Say a word or two about Hugh. Dr. Floyd Anderson, and I was more or less a contemporary of Hughes. First of all, when I came back from the war and back from my mission and participated in at the Y, getting my undergraduate degree before I went on for my doctorate, I invited Hugh over to speak to the Sunday school in Springville, where I was the head of the Sunday school, and he came and spoke. And I had some very distinct impressions of his approach to the gospel, in which he, when he came and talked, he talked so quietly and so self-absorbed as he talked with the group that we were with, to where it was incredibly powerful in the sense that everyone hung on every word that he said. And some of the words he said, of course, were incredibly significant. He was talking, and I remember it to this day, about words in certain papyrus and things that they had that applied to a valley, and therefore it was applicable in the Book of Mormon, and things that nobody else would ever pick up, things that nobody else would see. And then later on, when I came back, I was on the faculty of the Y with him for a number of years. I came back in 56 to teach at the Y for a number of years. And during that time, I interacted with him. In fact, before I was married, I dated his sister. And Barbara. Yeah. Not a daughter, a sister. Yeah. And so I perceived him from that perspective as well. And I would say, from my impression, and of course I approach it because I did my doctorate in the field of psychology, and therefore I approach it from that point of view. But I see him as kind of a person who used his profound intelligence to be different, to reach out and to explore things and expose the various and sundry ideas that he drew and absorbed from the various works that he studied in a way that nobody else would perhaps have picked up in the same fashion. And it gave him a sense of significance. It gave him a role, a position in the world. And he enjoyed that because he didn't have to go out and try and be flamboyant in any fashion to get response. He got it through the subtlety of the intelligence that he had as he presented his material. And from the faculty point of view, he was seen as sort of an odd guy, but a very nice guy. I mean, there wasn't something that would be offensive in his personality or anything of that kind, at least as I experienced him and so on. But I think that to see him as using this vehicle, the intellect, the quiet isolation that he had around him, a kind of personal warmth in his interaction sometimes, but sometimes no interaction, just simply living in his own world as a way of being that, in a sense, was both provoking and, in a sense, intriguing for a lot of the people who I think listened to him and were in his classes. And I think he was a powerful man, and I think the impact on the church has been tremendously significant, and I've liked what you've said about the way in which, in a sense, the things that he's written has opened your mind to a variety of ways of thinking. Because when I was on the faculty, there was a schism in the faculty, and that was that those who were what you might call liberal and those who were very conservative, and those who would think and propose different ideas that were not always in line with what the brethren might think, and those who, in a sense, therefore, were in struggling with this idea. And then so that there was this interaction between all of them going on at that particular time. Now, this was from about 1946 to 1956 to 1961. No. You can tell I'm getting old. I'm now 82, so I'm not functioning as well as I used to, I'm afraid. Anyway, it was from 65 to 56 to 61. I left 61 to head up a clinic in Los Angeles. Anyway, during that time, all I can say is that he was held with esteem and with regard and with respect by most of the faculty, Some of them are fully agreeing, and those who were, of course, having a real struggle with some of the ideas that he held out. But I think he's made a real contribution in the sense that he has stimulated what you're reflecting in not only his generation, but in yours. Thank you.
Let me briefly just pass the microphone to Quinn and let him respond to this question and the very insightful comment from it. And then we'd really like to open it up to a lot of your comments and questions because, as I think you've just really illustrated, there's this deep contrast between a generation who knows this person and sees his works developing and knows him as a person and us who are left just with, just like, as we've said, just kind of the books on the shelf. Let me let Quinn respond and then we'd really like to get as much of your input and comments or questions that you would have as we can get, and we've got still a good amount of time to do that.
Well, my parents and some of my grandparents are pretty darn liberal themselves, so it's hard to gauge Dr. Nibley's impact on that part of their lives and my life. Again, I feel like because he was accepted, despite some of his more liberal ideas, because he was accepted by the church on the whole, I think that his statements and his ideas were a good jumping off point for other liberals in the church. And, you know, there are all sorts of ways that you can go from that, and we might feel like some people will jump too far and others are too scared to jump far enough, but I do feel like he's had an influence on these heretical liberal thoughts like being a conservationist or a pacifist or things like that that I'm sure will condemn me all. But okay, I'm done.
As you have comments, we'll put the microphone back here. Because everything here is being recorded, if you could come up and speak to the group from the microphone, it would be appreciated.
As one of the few in this room, well, there are others, who can remember what Utah was like 40 years ago, I would like to point out to you that it was much more liberal then than it is now. That at that time we had a Republican governor, a Republican senator, Republican representative from Utah County. The very strong Republican hue of Utah, well, as late as Gunn McKay, we had a Republican representative from Utah County. The very conservative Republican view of Utah, which exists today, is due primarily to abortion.
Which a panel will be discussing right after this one. So if anyone wants to stay, it's another understaffed panel.
I realize that this is a panegyric and a testimony meeting, but I was put off just a little bit by the title of the session, Standing on the Shoulders of a Giant. This has been a discussion without context. I'm wondering, and it's unfair. By the way, I feel responsible for Quinn, genetically and some other ways as well. Sorry about that. But I love him. In Hugh Nibley's time, if you were just a visitor here, you'd think that he was the only intellectual in the church. I'm wondering how his influence compares with that of Lowell Benyon, Sterling McMurrin, Eugene England, Juanita Brooks, all of basically the same generation. And would you like to discuss anything along that line?
Yeah, since this is being recorded, I'll just edit some things, which I'm not good at. But I think maybe as the I think maybe as maybe a more appropriate title would be Standing on the Shoulders of One of the Giants. For me in particular, when Rick approached me about this, I think maybe Hugh Nibley's status as sort of an approved historian or an approved source of ideas for the church, he's the one that we're most likely to come across first. And we'll, you know, in our explorations of trying to find out more, we come across these others as we read as well. But I think the sheer volume of his work and then the availability of his work makes him one of the first LDS scholars that many of us come across. And so when you're just starting to venture beyond the scriptures, he's going to be one of the first that you run into. And like I said earlier, you know, he's not just a source of knowledge that has flowed into my mind and my spirit single-handedly. You know, some other figures in my life that have helped me to build my own understanding of the church have been, you know, simply people like my parents, other gospel scholars certainly, but other apostles and prophets and LDS scholars that have all served to build my understanding of the church and the gospel. And that's why, you know, I think it's an appropriate title, but it's focused on Hugh Nibley, and that's, I think, you know, Rick is probably better at talking about other people than me, so.
Who else? Got about a little over 5 minutes.
I think the greatest influence that Hugh Nibley had on my life happened somewhat over 55 years ago when, to use the biblical term, he begat me. My name is Tom Nibley. I grew up in the family. He did have considerable influence on my life. One thing that has struck me in discussions like this. First of all, if he were around, he would say this is totally silly and utter foolishness, and be quietly flattered at the same time. But the essence of his life was his message. And his message was that the gospel is true. If everybody in the world forgot that Hugh Nibley existed tomorrow, but remembered that the gospel is true, he wouldn't mind a bit. As a matter of fact, most of the things that he did in his life that gave him the greatest satisfaction, he was fond of saying in certain intimate groups, were things that the world knew nothing about, that were not out in his books, that were not in his classrooms. When he was asked, how is it that you can learn so much? His answer was usually, I pray about it. And then through the power of prayer and the Holy Spirit, he would be led to various sources. Reagan is said to have said, trust but verify. Hugh Nibley, you might say, would say, listen to the Spirit, but footnote. So if we're going to remember Hugh Nibley, the thing that we should remember more than that, more than him, is that he had a profound testimony of the Savior Jesus Christ. He had a profound knowledge of the gospel of Jesus Christ. He took great delight in finding out more things about the gospel. But it was because it was the gospel that it was important. And he would talk about all religion is cosmology. He started out life wanting to be an astronomer. And he never lost that delight in astronomy. He was getting Astronomy Magazine every month
up until the time he died, and he would always get excited when it arrived. He was watching CNN, watching all the things that were happening in the world, and more than that, what was happening beyond the world with the space program, with the probes that went out to Saturn, and the Hubble, and the spacecraft. He was fascinated by so many things. He loved all these things, but he considered all of them simply adjuncts to the gospel of Jesus Christ, without which they were nothing. They would not exist. Christ being the creator of heaven and earth and creator of all these other things. So if there's anything that you get from the life and the works of Hugh Nibley, it should be this. Jesus Christ is the Son of God, the Savior of the world, and that if you want to know more about his teachings, about his gospel, you can do all the reading you want, that's good, but pray about it.
If I could find a rock big enough to hide under, I would right now. As you introduced yourself, I turned to Quinn and said, this is exactly what I was terrified of. If anything could show how different our generation's view of Hugh Nibley is because we don't know him as a person, it would be that beautiful testimony and tribute that you've given to your father, who not only do you know him as a person, but really as a person. I'm in awe of what you said and think that it's a perfect comment and a perfect way to draw to the close of this discussion that I am still wondering if it's produced anything worth producing for anyone in the room except for us. The two of us, I think, have had a wonderful time and have enjoyed not just the discussion but particularly your presence and the amazing insight from all of you, and particularly, as I said, that wonderful tribute. Let me just, I guess, say that this separation of a generation does, it's different. If we were talking about someone separated by several generations, if we were here talking about Joseph Smith, then it's like anyone's opinion in the room would be somewhat equally valid. I think Joseph Smith this. Well, I think Joseph Smith, you know. But to be here and to pretend to know anything about Hugh Nibley in front of you, and as we discussed doing the panel and more people dropped out of sheer terror, we reminded ourselves over and over again, what we're talking about is us, his influence on us, what he means to us, because we know so little comparatively about him. But I would like to say, as a tribute to your father, that he has had a profound influence, and there is a reason that his name stands out above his contemporaries, as great as their contributions were. That steadfast faith and that absolute love that you could just feel for the gospel, for the temple, and for Christ, for the Lord, for the atonement. There was never any question of that. They're so strong, and it was communicated so well and so powerfully. I think it has had an absolute, just a huge influence on our generation. And we're very grateful to all of you for being patient as we sort of tried to ferret that out, however inably we may have. And I think
is there just a minute left?
Yeah, please.
Can I just add my
voice? Love you too.
I've been pretty much silent throughout the symposium. But Hugh Nibley has been a huge influence in the household I grew up in. The fact that I still have an interest in symposia like this has a great deal to do with the works of Hugh Nibley and the career and the character of Hugh Nibley. In my household, we had a great love for the gathering and understanding of eternal truths, and there was a heavy emphasis on personal revelation. I wasn't made to feel as though I had to conform with the leadership of the church, and today I really don't have much of an interest in what the leadership of the church thinks that I should know about my eternal welfare. But because of the character and the diplomacy of Hugh Nibley, I still have a great interest in church matters as an observer. And I love the way he did it. I love the way that he walked a fine line between what was
what was church-friendly, or should I say church-member-friendly, and what was really doctrine with teeth. My father was a friend of Hugh Nibley's, met with him often, discussing matters as relevant as Relife, issues that Hugh, I think, had an insight on, but yet he didn't parade out there, because he knew how to walk that walk. I'm very grateful for Brother Nibley's contribution as a member of the generation that we're talking about here. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks so much. That's all we had. As I mentioned, there is another seriously understaffed student panel in 15 minutes in the same room if anyone's remotely interested.
We really are working on the air conditioning.
And it is insufferably hot.